Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Bitcoin Infinity Academy, brought to you by Plan B Network and Bitbox. I'm Knut Swanholm, and I'm here today, as always, with Luke DeWolf. How are we doing today, Luke?
Doing great, Knut. Thanks. This is really exciting. This first chapter here of Sovereignty Through Mathematics, Everything a Trade. This is, I think we both were saying we already know it basically by heart. It's that memorable, so I'm excited to dive into it.
Yes. So shall we just get at it? I think that's how we do this, right?
I think so. So I think I'll just remind, if you want to follow along, the chapter is available on Nostr. We've got a nice primal link, I think, that we'll drop in the description here. And learn more about how to join the Academy at our Geyser page. All the links are in the description. So I think with that, shall we dive in?
Absolutely.
Okay, let's do it. So this is the first time we're doing this. I'll just explain that. But I think the format here is going to make a lot of sense once we get into it. Basically, I'm going to be reading each paragraph, and then Knut and I, we're going to discuss it and see what ideas come out of it. So yeah, let's just do it. Everything a Trade, Chapter 1 of Sovereignty Through Mathematics. All human interaction can be defined as trade. Yes. All human interaction. Every time a human being interacts with another, an exchange takes place. In every conversation we have, we exchange information with each other. Even the most trivial information is of some value to the other person. If information didn't have any value to us, we wouldn't talk to each other. Either what the other person says is valuable to us, or we find it valuable to give information to them. Oftentimes both. At the core of all human interaction that isn't violent, both parties perceive that they gain some value from it. Otherwise, the interaction wouldn't have taken place at all. Civilizations begin this way. Two people finding it valuable to interact with each other. That's all it takes. Knut, what did you mean by that?
I think this is the perfect way to start your Bitcoin journey. Understanding this simple fact about human beings and how we interact, that we have two means of communication, of interacting with one another. One is communication and the other is violence or aggression. And as we are going to see over the course of all of these courses, consensual interactions, voluntary interactions, are always preferable to violent ones. Bitcoin is peace.
Bitcoin is peace. Yeah. I mean, the funny thing here is I really like what you say about this is the perfect start. Completely agree with that, because but it's counterintuitive, right? Like the message that Bitcoin is like all this in the mainstream, that Bitcoin is all about crypto and all of this, like number go up, everything related to that. And no, like it's a total mind shift when we approach Bitcoin from the philosophical perspective, or that Bitcoin is actually the result of coming to the understanding of the world in a completely different way. And I mean, this is what I originally liked about your books before we'd even met, was that just an introduction to these alternate approaches to thinking about the world that ultimately is Austrian economics is at the base, right? But I didn't know that. And isn't it basically also true that you didn't know that too at the time of writing?
No, when I wrote this chapter, I hadn't really done a deep dive into Austrian economics yet. So in hindsight, I'm very proud that I had come to these conclusions without knowing too much about Mises and Rothbard and all of that. But it is so simple. And I think everyone who just thinks about these things will inevitably end up with drawing these conclusions, because these are things that you cannot argue with without running into a logical contradiction. And that's the basis of Austrian economics. And it's not really debatable. If you could debate it, like I'd love to see the ideas of Austrian economics challenged somehow, because to be honest, some of the axioms might be wrong. It's just that they are built around not being wrong, because that you can't really argue against them. That's why they're axioms. First paragraph.
First paragraph. We'll continue, I think, quite a bit of discussion on Austrian economics as we go here. So I'll save some of my additional comments on the matter for other times when we're going to hit things more directly. And this is going to be a theme here also, that we're going to hit some of the ideas multiple times. You know, like it comes up over and over again in the course of your books, basically. But we're always going to hit it from a slightly different angle and build on the ideas. I think that's what we've been so excited about as we go here. So I'll move on to the next paragraph here. So what constitutes value? What we find valuable is entirely subjective. A comforting hug, for example, probably has a different value to a two-year-old than it has to a withered army general. Even the most basic action, such as breathing, encapsulates the whole value spectrum. We tend to forget that even a single breath of air can be of immense value to us under the right circumstances. A single breath is worth more than anything on the planet to a desperate free diver trapped under ice, while worth nothing to a person with a death wish in clean forest air on a sunny summer day. Value is derived from supply and demand is always subjective. Supply is not. Okay, so supply and demand is always subjective, supply is not. Really good encapsulation there. I think this is another new thing for most people, wouldn't you say?
Yeah, absolutely. And this is sort of how trade is the bridge between the subjective and the objective, between the wills and wants of people and the world around us, really. And why property, like owning something, is what bridges the two worlds, and trading objects with one another and trading goods and services. That's really it. And there's another thing I thought of when hearing this again, and it's the concept of breathing. Breathing can be a human action, but doesn't necessarily have to be. And this, here we go into deep Austrian economics, I guess, because it's about the distinction between action and just instinct. So most of the time when you breathe, you don't think about it. You don't do it with purpose. And this is how the Austrian school differentiates between just basic instinct and like animalistic behaviors and action, because human action is purposeful behavior, is the very first axiom of Austrian economics. So if you do something with intent, then it's an action. And you can also not do something with intent, which is why inaction is also an action. But yeah, main point of the paragraph, I would say, is that demand is subjective and supply is not.
Yeah, and well, an interesting thing here, since we're kind of going into some weeds here, I think it's really to the disservice of Austrian economics that's even the terminology used at all. And I think that's the biggest misconception about Austrian economics in general, that it's really just describing how the world works. And that's what makes it entirely different from all mainstream economics, which is really this predictive price modeling and trying to think about how the world is going to work if you make all these manipulative changes. But Austrian economics really just is a description of how the world works. And when that clicked to me, that you know, kind of more libertarian types and the kind of political conclusions, I think, of thinking in an Austrian way is actually different from the Austrian economics itself. It's not describing a political economic framework. It's just describing human action.
Yeah,
right?
It's about methodology and epistemology. So all it does is say that all else given being equal, if X, then Y. Like so that's the how you draw conclusions from this type of thinking. And I think the reason it's not more popular, the main reason is all of the confusion going on, because we say schools of economics when there aren't really different schools. There's how the world works, and there's a bunch of word salads about different tasting word salads about how it ought to work or how people think it works. But that's not it. Austrian economics is just as much about setting the boundaries for what we can know as it is the knowledge itself. Like, so main point here is that this is not debatable. Value is absolutely subjective. It's subjective between people and between situations. A table, for instance, can be a tool for the same person, like, who wants to sit down and have a meal at the table, but it can also be an obstacle if it's on the freeway and he's trying to drive on the freeway. Then the table is not a useful tool, but an obstacle, meaning it has a completely different value, even a negative value. So valuing stuff is something we do all the time, and these scales always change, and we always have a scale of preference that can be ordered, like, from highest priority to lowest priority. But we can never measure how much more valuable one thing is to another, just that it is more or less valuable. So it can be arranged ordinally, but never cardinally. And this is another thing in Austrian economics. Yeah.
No. Again, I think it's just the point of that all the other schools are people trying to control the world, basically trying to impose their will on how the world ought to be, but instead of just describing how it works. And I think there's a real value in understanding how the world works. That's been the biggest thing that clicked with me when understanding this stuff, is that if you can see a little bit behind the meaning of why people do things, it's so much easier to understand, well, yeah, really, really simply why anyone does anything, and get to the root of their motivations and have a conversation with people and understand what's going on, all coming back to incentives, basically. I think that's really valuable. And I think some of the conclusions towards the end of this chapter really allude at Bitcoin's role in trying to smooth out some of the incentive issues that we see in the system. So, yeah. I don't know. Do you have anything more here, or should we just continue?
Yeah, I would just add that I don't think the other schools of economics are, like, deliberately manipulative and want to control people. I think they are what they are because for the longest time, like, people thought that empiricism was the only way of doing science, like testing a hypothesis and measuring the results in the real world and then adjusting the hypothesis based on what those results were. But economics is a completely different science because you can't use empiricism to either confirm or deny anything, since humans have free will. We have no choice but to have it. So humans can decide to do something else the next time you measure. Markets are always dynamic, which forces you to use a completely different method of thinking about these things. So methodology here is really the key to understanding what's going on. And without these thoughts, Bitcoin couldn't have existed. Like, Satoshi definitely had at least some understanding of Austrian economics, probably a very deep one. Otherwise, he wouldn't have come up with Bitcoin. That's my theory anyway.
Honestly, I think that's a bit of maybe a hot take. I think it's impossible to know if this was what was going on back at the time. But you might be right. But maybe people can stumble on things without having the knowledge and understanding, right? Because you've said yourself that you didn't ever read any Mises you wrote this book.
That's true. Like, even a blind hen can find a golden pebble.
Bitcoin's definitely a golden pebble, or more than that, much more than that.
Yeah, it's a golden goose, which you shouldn't sacrifice for a Kinder egg.
Yes, that's maybe an in-joke, but good term anyway. I think let's tackle the next one here. Since all of our lives are limited by time, time is the ultimate example of a scarce, tradable resource. We all sell our time. We sell it to others, and we sell it to ourselves. Everyone sells their time either through a product that took them a certain amount of time to produce or as a service. And services always take time. If you're an employee on a steady payroll, you typically sell 8 hours of your day every day to your employer. If you're doing something you truly love to do, that 8-hour day still belongs to you, in a way, since you're doing what you'd probably be doing anyway if you had been forced to do it for free. Sometimes we sacrifice time in order to acquire something in the future. An education, for instance, gives no immediate reward, but can lead to a better paying, more satisfying job in the future. An investment is basically our future self trading time with our present self at a discount. Once again, every human interaction viewed as a trade. Knut?
Yeah, I love the middle of this paragraph. It is perfectly describing what we're doing right now. And how we own our time by getting paid for doing what we would be doing anyway because we love doing it. So, that's my immediate thought about this. And also there's a hint here at medium of exchange over time and space, which is a concept we get into in Clown World, far off in the future for this show, but you're trading with your future self when you're storing value. So I don't really like the term store of value. I prefer medium of exchange over time because what you're actually doing is you're trading with your future self. So all interactions take place in time. So without the time dimension, you can't have any trade.
Yeah, I'm still a store of value guy. I like the term as a description. And it's good to point out that we're not exactly the same person. We bicker like a married couple all the time. But the medium exchange over time idea, that definitely is an interesting way of thinking about it. I still value the other terms too, because I think they're a little more straightforward for people to grasp. But medium of exchange over time. And in this paragraph, I like the allusion to sacrifice. And I mean, this is a concept that civilizationally, basically, the concept of being low time preference, or in other words, sacrificing immediate gratification for gain in the future, that's how civilization developed. And societies that started to take up ritual sacrifice in order to literally practice sacrificing, to get their mindset right. Basically, that's my understanding of the purpose of sacrifice. Like, taking, I don't know, the last bushel of wheat or whatever it is that people farm, and burning it, or actually many types of sacrifice was even that you just had it in a feast, like you ritually sacrifice it, but then everyone eats it or whatever it is, but you give something up in order to mimic the scarcity of losing something, so that you have the mindset of that you need to get better and you need to continually do the thing that moves society forward. As soon as cultures started to realize that, then there's more and more archaeological evidence that they grow bigger and bigger, and they're able to better withstand difficult conditions, especially winters. Like, none of the societies that developed in Northern Europe would have been able to get through anything if they couldn't make it through the winter, basically. So they learned low time preference, right? And it's just tying this all together to the idea of that if you can get your head around that maybe doing something now to better yourself and delaying gratification is going to get you better rewards in the future, that's something for every individual to learn. That's something for every family, group of people to learn, and honestly, I think the world is going to be much better off if we can collectively, more people, more individuals can pick up on these ideas and help their local environments and groups to practice it.
Yeah, and in Bitcoin, we sacrifice goats. You know, whenever a goat, a greatest of all time thinker, starts shitcoining, for instance, we have to slay our heroes and sacrifice them.
Yeah, that's not foreshadowing anything about you, is it, Knut?
I certainly hope not. The proper sacrifice here, like the point here, is that delayed gratification sacrificing your time now for a future gratification, that is the proper way of looking at sacrifice. That is the thing that actually yields results when you sacrifice something.
Mm. Yeah, great point here. Okay, on to the next one. And I think I'll just say here, because this is going to be it's not like a sometimes paragraphs are going to be relating to the one previously in a way that sort of is. We'll just remember that this came after the last one.
Yeah.
So, it's rooted in physics. For every action, there is an equally large reaction. Trade is at the very core of what we are, and the tools we use to conduct trade matter a lot to the outcome of each transaction. Money is our primary tool for expressing value to each other, and if the creation of money is somewhat corrupt or unethical, that rot spreads down throughout society, from top to bottom. Shit flows downhill, as the expression goes. Knut?
If I was to write this book again now, I wouldn't have used the word physics. And the reason I would avoid it is not because I don't agree with that every action has an equally big reaction, but that I think it's important to distinguish between human action and all other branches of science. Physics is an empirical science. Praxeology is not. Which is also, by the way, why Bitcoin is not digital energy. I don't like that phrasing. I think it's way more complex than that. But we're going to get into some other examples like this, where I use like physics metaphors that I will try to explain as best as I can why they're flawed. They might be good to just ease someone into this new way of thinking, but at the end of the day, all physics metaphors for Bitcoin are basically wrong.
Fair enough, but I mean, good to kind of point it out, and again, like, wrongness is subjective, also, sort of. The metaphors themselves, if they help people understand things better, they're not wrong in the sense of being empirically wrong. In those cases, they help people understand a concept, and I don't think that's wrong.
No, they might be like objectively wrong, but subjectively right. If that makes any sense, if
they're subjectively helpful,
subjectively helpful as a tool of understanding other stuff, something on your journey. But this is, I think, this paragraph, like, it kind of explains itself. It's not very complicated. If money printing goes on, everything else gets corrupt. And this is where I'd like to recommend a guy that I recently interviewed, Joe Rogers, his movie, What is the Problem? There's a little animated movie. If you Google What is the Problem, you'll get a very good basic explanation of what happens when the states start running the money printer.
Yeah, good. And actually, this is a good time to point out that we're actually, with the Bitcoin Infinity Academy, we're being quite a bit more on time with this. Like, this episode, we're recording it right now on a Saturday. This is going to be out on Monday. But our Bitcoin Infinity show, we have a big backlog, and we take a lot of time to release the episodes and get them out, just for the the difficulties of life and all this. So. We might reference things that haven't actually come out yet, but we're going to stay on time and fairly topical with these Academy episodes, which is going to be pretty fun. But yeah, I agree. And I mean, another thing too is that we're going to be touching on topics that are better explored later. And I think we know that sometimes that we go deeper into something. So I think. Bear with us if you want to hear a little bit more about something specific that we're talking about here. Maybe our answer is going to be a little bit of like, hey, like, tune in to a later chapter here. But we're also happy to I think flesh some things out independent of being tied to a book chapter, right, Knut?
Yeah, or just join the Academy and pose a question in the group, and we will bring it up.
Yeah, that's what I was getting at. Like, we're happy to discuss things a little more kind of out of band, but I think we will hit them also in depth as the ideas come up. So,
yeah,
yeah.
These earlier books are thought of idea embryos for what was to come later, and culminating in Clown World. We'll get to that.
Yeah, when we get to Clown World, we're going deep. It's gonna be fun.
Yeah. This academy is all about delayed gratification.
There we go. Good, good. Okay, on to the next one. So what is money? Or rather, what ought money to be? In order for two persons to interact when a mutual coincidence of needs is absent, a medium of exchange is needed in order to execute a transaction. A mutual coincidence of needs might be, you need my three goats and I need your cow. Or even, both of us need a hug. In the absence of a physical good or service suitable for a specific transaction, money can fulfill the role of a medium of exchange. What most people fail to realize is that the value of money, just as the value of everything else, is entirely subjective. You don't have to spend it. The problem with every incarnation of money that mankind has ever tried is that its value always gets diluted over time due to inflation in various forms. Inflation makes traditional money a bad store of value, and money needs to be a good store of value in order to be a good investment, or in other words, a good substitute for your time and your effort over time. Bitcoin tries to solve this problem by introducing absolute scarcity to the world, a concept that mankind has never encountered before. To comprehend what such a discovery means for the future, one needs to understand the fundamentals of what value is and that we assign a certain value to everything we encounter in life, whether we admit it or not. In short, we assign value to everything we do. Value is derived from supply and demand, and supply is objective while demand is subjective. Great summary.
Yeah, thank you. I mean, this is at the core of what Bitcoin is, right? You have a potential infinite demand and an absolutely finite supply. And if you combine those two, number can only go up forever. That is the conclusion here. So while that seems utopian, you're living through it right now, whether you want to or not. You could either be on this train or not, and nothing stops this train. So a crucial point here is that no civilization ever happens before money is discovered. There is no barter civilization. Civilizations don't emerge from just barter. You need something. You need a medium of exchange. And my favorite definition of money is Hans Hermann Hoppe's definition, which is that it's the best insurance against uncertainty available, or the best defense against uncertainty available. Because that's all money is supposed to do. It's supposed to give you ease of mind so that you can go into the future knowing that you can use the fruits of your labor later and exchange it for something else that you need more than the other guy. Like, it's very simple like that. It's just that we have all of human history tainted by bad money and by corrupted money, unethical money, whatever you may call it, inflationary money. So in that sense, Bitcoin rewrites all of history. Like, we've never had a perfect representation of history before, but now we do.
Yeah, damn. I mean, like, the whole thing here, when you say that, I was going to that, yeah, there are times in history when the money is a little bit better. And of course, we never had the technological stack for Bitcoin to exist before. We needed some kind of mechanism of the technology. I mean, we're not going to get into a history lesson of what had to come before Bitcoin, but basically the proof of work mechanism and coordinating different nodes in a network. Like, you couldn't have had Bitcoin if you can't communicate with people, basically.
I would say, from my point of view, that is true and untrue at the same time. And the reason is, if everyone was absolutely 100% honest all the time, we could have had Bitcoin. So the only reason we need all the technology and all the proof of work and all of these things is to prevent people from being dishonest. But if people just had been honest to begin with, we wouldn't have needed Bitcoin. That's the way I view that.
No, that's a clip right there, I think, maybe. Let's see. Here, let's continue, I think. Free trade emerges out of human interaction naturally, and it is not an idea that was forced upon us at any specific point in time. The idea that markets should be regulated and governed, on the other hand, was. Free trade is just the absence of forceful interference in an interaction between two humans by a third party. There's nothing intrinsically wrong or immoral about an exchange of a good or service. Every objection to this is a byproduct of the current global narrative. A narrative that tells us that the world is divided into different nations and that people in these nations operate under various sets of laws, depending on what jurisdiction they find themselves in. All of these ideas are man-made. No species, except humans, does this to themselves. Animals do trade, but they don't do politics. What did you mean by this paragraph, Knut?
Yes, it's to emphasize the point that capitalism is not optional. Like it's not a man-made concept. It's something that emerges naturally from human behavior and even animal behavior to some extent. The term capital good refers to something that you can use at a later time or use in the production of other goods, ultimately leading to a consumer good, to the production of a consumer good. And accumulating these things and trading them with one another is what leads to civilization. That is the process of civilization. So saying that capitalism is evil is very, very strange to me. And I think the reason the word has been so skewed over the years is like the word liberalism. It ought to mean like people are free to do whatever the fuck they want, but it doesn't in the modern context of the word. So the same is true for capitalism. I think the reason the word is so tainted is because of money printing at the end of the day, that some asshole has been able to print money and then blame the failures of the free market, so-called failures of the free market, which are really failures of the boom bust boom cycle that follows from money printing and political interventionism. Like, this is always the root of the problem, and it's always marketed as the remedy or the antidote to the solution to the problem, when it's actually the underlying cause. And I think most people get this wrong because we're constantly being bombarded by state-funded information channels that give us this worldview. Public schooling is one, and government-subsidized media outlets is another. And everyone working there, they're doing their best, and I think they try their best to give accurate information to people, but they're also brainwashed by the notion of by politics and by the money being corrupt to begin with, skews everything.
Yeah, and I mean, I think a nuance here also that I think you were getting at is that everything we call capitalism, especially the most capitalistic places, it's all the problems really just come from the government intervention, and this is one of those things getting into the political realm of this. The reason I think why people who get into Austrian economics eventually start to lean libertarian or right or something, anarcho-capitalist even, is just that it becomes clear that interventions in the market are the problem. And it's really what makes the capitalism not work, the free trade between individuals not work. The people who are closest to the money printer are deciding to give money to different people, companies, groups, picking winners, essentially. And they're also choosing to tax one group or another differently. So it's picking winners and losers. And we don't have any idea of what it would really look like in a real capitalist system. I mean, I saw a breakdown of basically all the ways that the U.S. healthcare system is interfered with, all the way down from insurance being mandated so that hospitals can bill basically whatever they want because insurance companies have to pay for it. And then therefore, insurance companies raise their premiums a whole ton, thereby making it more expensive for people to afford insurance. And it just all, it trickles down. Monopolies on patents, enforced regulations that mean that smaller companies cannot compete in the medical space. Just a crazy number of interventions that distort everything. And so the so-called big capitalist healthcare system isn't a capitalist at all. And theoretically, the cure is going to be more socialism. That's really not going to work, I think.
No, and this is, there are so many layers to this. So it's sort of impossible to imagine a world without interventionism. Except if you're a Bitcoiner and do a lot of hanging out with other Bitcoiners. I mean, what we're doing right now, Luke, like you and I are trading our time and effort with one another, and it's a mutually beneficial thing. And so is the audience here. Everyone watching this does so by their own volition. They are here because they want to be here. And why couldn't the entire world work like that? Why couldn't everything be consensual and voluntary? And thinking that some things have to be enforced is a product of that very same kind of enforcement. We only think that because we have been forced to live in systems where you draw those conclusions from necessity, because there are assholes with guns threatening you to take you away and put you in a cell if you don't do what they think is wrong or right. Because at the end of the day, who is to say what is a problem with the market? Like, that is entirely subjective too. Like, who gets to set the framing? Like, this company is too big. I mean, says who? Even what people view as the most capitalistic institutions of the world, like multinational corporations, they are the size they are mostly because of interventionism quenching all the competition. So, the interventionism helps these large entities. It helps them form artificial monopolies in all areas of life by just disallowing every potential competitor to challenge them. That's the main mechanism that keeps, that makes monopolies happen at all. On a completely free market, theoretically, a monopoly situation cannot happen. Which is counterintuitive to most people. And we'll get into the weeds of this in later books, but this is not a discussion for now, I guess.
No, my only remark here is that I'm enjoying how spicy we're already getting. It's not so spicy, but like it's getting a little bit spicy at this point already. So yeah, we're having fun. This series is going to be an absolute blast. I'm already really enjoying it. Yeah, let's continue. Bitcoin and the idea of truly sound, absolutely scarce money inevitably makes you question human societal structures in general and the nature of money in particular. Once you realize that this Pandora's box of an idea can't be closed again by anyone, everything is put into perspective. Once you realize that it is now possible for anyone with a decently sized brain to store any amount of wealth in that brain, or to beam wealth anonymously to any other brain in the world without anyone else ever knowing, everything you were ever told about human society is turned on its head. Everything you thought you knew about taxes, social class, capitalism, socialism, economics, or even democracy falls apart like a house of cards in a hurricane. It is, in fact, impossible to comprehend the impact Bitcoin will have on the planet without also understanding basic Austrian economics and what the libertarian worldview stems from. Okay.
Yeah, this reminds me, that Pandora's box sentence there reminds me of something Michael Dunworth, my friend Michael Dunworth, said on a panel we were on at Bitcoin Alive in Sydney just a couple of weeks back. And that is that Bitcoin is the first thing that humanity has ever built that we can't break. We cannot undo this. Like, we have built something that we cannot stop. And not wanting to own a bit of that, or to be part of that, is just insanity. Like, and I mean, time will tell, but everything points to Bitcoin being completely unbreakable, which is just mind-blowing in itself, isn't it?
It completely is. And I mean, this is another one of these things where I just get back to when you get it, you get it. When you take the orange pill, you can't untake it.
No.
You know? It's like you've seen behind the curtain and just nothing else ever makes sense anymore.
No.
Except in the context of Bitcoin. And so, coming to these realizations is important. And you know, I say it a lot because I think it's important to say this. Like, the reason we talk about this stuff as much as we do and we go deep into it, I mean, there's so many layers to this. This we're doing this for our own benefit. We're doing this for the benefit of everyone listening, right? And I mean, I think my assumption is anyone who's listening to this at this point is going to be already pretty deep into the Bitcoin rabbit hole already. But wouldn't it be awesome if this is like one of these things that, you know, hey, you've just got your first Bitcoin, here, check out this series on sovereignty through mathematics and really dig deep into this stuff. I mean, what's the impact that us doing this could have in the future here? But not specifically this series, but just all the talk about Bitcoin and getting better at the ideas and understanding them better. Yeah, like conviction deepening is important, and being able to explain these things to other people is important, because even though we can't break it, we don't know how long it's going to take before the world is overtaken by Bitcoin.
Before it breaks everything else.
Before it breaks everything else, yeah. So no, I mean, I just keep getting more, not bullish exactly, it's the wrong word. It's just, when we talk about this stuff, it gets me excited about where we're going to be in the future here, when more and more people think about these ideas and start to change the way they live their lives. Because maybe that's another thing here. I definitely live life in a different way after discovering Bitcoin and after seeing that everything, all the ways of operating before were just a hamster's wheel to get ahead in the rat race, or whatever other metaphor makes sense. But you figure out Bitcoin and so many other things start to make more sense, and you just live your life a totally different way. And I don't know, I'm just hopeful that through discussing these ideas, more people can come to the same realization. I don't have much more of a point than that. It's just no, always awesome to think about.
I view it as like the life I led before and like life, how you view life in general before Bitcoin, is that success always, this false notion that success necessarily has to come at someone else's expense, which Bitcoin sort of points out that is completely 100% false. One person's success can benefit everyone else on Earth simultaneously if we just start using the proper denominator. Like, it's as simple as that. That was a complicated outlandish statement. We'll get into the weeds of why in the upcoming chapters.
Exactly. We'll get into it more later. Last paragraph here, and interesting anecdote I think coming up, or interesting thought nugget. Imagine growing up in an Amish community. Until your 16th birthday, you're purposely completely shielded off from the outside world. Information about how the world really works is very limited to you, since internet access and even TVs and radios are forbidden within the community. Well, from a certain perspective, we're all Amish. How money really works is never emphasized enough through traditional media or public educational institutions. Most people believe that the monetary system is somehow sound and fair, when there's overwhelming evidence to the contrary all over the globe. Ask yourself, do you remember being taught about the origins of money in school? Me neither. I don't believe that there's some great global conspiracy behind the fact that the ethics of money creation isn't a school subject, but rather that plain old ignorance is to blame for the lack of such a subject primarily. As soon as their math skill limit is reached, people seem to stop caring about numbers. The difference between a million and a billion seems lost on a depressingly large part of the world's population. In the chapters ahead, we'll explore the pitfalls of central banking, how money pops into existence, and how inflation, keeps us all on a leash. Okay.
Yeah, the difference between a million and a billion is about a billion. The Amish part here is funny. Like, do you know why the Amish weren't affected by COVID at all?
Yeah, go ahead.
They didn't have a TV. They didn't have TVs. So that's why. Like, so there's, if anything, I've changed my views on the Amish since I wrote this book. I think they're pretty based. I mean, they're not worried about climate change because they don't have TVs. Like, they live life. And you may say that it's ignorant and like shielded from the rest of the world, and they're not getting all the information. But they're also not getting any of the propaganda. So it's a double-sided coin. I personally believe you should like have access to as much information as possible. It's just that take care of your filters. Filter the information properly. That can be hard to do. One simple trick is to always follow the money to see what people's real intentions are. Watch their actions rather than listening to their words, especially politicians and bureaucrats. The Amish are good at that. So good on them.
Absolutely. And well, you know, I think the other point you have here is that like none of this being covered in school. I mean, there's something really there. Like honestly, it's hard to not see some grand conspiracy here to kind of just shut everyone up and keep us all in our little boxes because this stuff really should be fundamental. The fundamentals of how to live life are what should be taught in school, not esoteric things that might be useful later. I think much of mathematics in school beyond real basics actually is pretty darn useless to most people, like trigonometry and things like that. But they completely gloss over the scarcity of money and how to use money and all of these useful things, right? It's so hard. I don't know, what do you think?
Any inflation is theft. I mean, read Rothbard, people. Like, it's always theft. A violation has happened if prices go up. And this is so hard for people to understand because prices have always gone up. No one living today has ever experienced falling prices in anything but, say, like computers, which have such a fast technological deflation that the prices actually go down even in fiat terms. But everything else should go down too. It's as simple as that. And if you denominate in Bitcoin, it does. This is what this is all about. This is what this course is about, to teach people these things and another way of viewing the world. I mean, also with the conspiracy thing, I would say never attribute to malice what can be explained by retardation. Like, I think that oftentimes it's just that the whole system is incentives are set the way they are. And like, even money printing, like, is not someone conspiring to manipulate everyone else. It's just that the temptation, the incentive to print money if you can, is too strong. So humans have never been able to resist the temptation to take a little more for yourself than you're actually entitled to, which is why we can't leave anyone in charge of the money printer, because the psychopaths will like flock to those positions in society where they get to use others. So a psychopath is bound to end up in controlling the money printer at the end of the day. And this is why the incentives were there before the malice, if you know what I mean. Before the bad guy came there, the incentive to become a bad guy was there. So it can be explained by that. What Bitcoin does, it provides us with a system where actually following the rules is more profitable than trying to break them, which completely changes the incentive. If there's any such thing as a positive conspiracy, this would be it. Like, we're actually scheming to make people behave in different ways. It's yeah.
No, it's great. I mean, the funny thing is that good intentions, people can have good intentions, right? Like it can be completely reasonable to think that it would be nice to order the world in such a way that everyone gets everything taken care of and society runs all smoothly and all this. But the sinister nature is that people who can take advantage of such systems will. And I think we'll explore those ideas more in the future. But for now, I think this was an excellent chapter. And to our listeners, hey, we're done the chapter now. Go leave us a comment. Tell us what you think. If you're watching on YouTube or Rumble, go leave us a comment there. If you've been listening on Fountain or something, send us a tweet or a post on Noster about it. Let us know what you think. And looking forward to continuing the conversation. But
yes, yeah. And about continuing the conversation, the road to hell is paved with good intentions, as we know, which is why I think there's a highway to hell and just a stairway to heaven. We'll get into one of my most controversial chapters ever, I think, next week, or not next week. This is coming out like just a couple of days after this, which is chapter 2 of Sovereignty Through Mathematics, called Financial Atheism. And I'll explain how my views have changed on that since I wrote it, and what I still agree with and what I might disagree with. So looking forward to that and to defining the words and all the stuff. So yeah, welcome back next time.
Welcome back next time. Perfect. I was going to ask you, did you have any last words? But I think you just covered that. Am I right?
Yeah, these were my last words. Yes.
These were. All right. Well, hey, so before we wrap up, I think we'll just say a big shout out to, first of all, everyone who's joined the Academy so far. If you want to be involved in the discussions and support what we're doing, the easiest way is to join the Academy, either join the specific course or pick up the Mithril Adamantium membership so that you have access to absolutely everything. All the details are on our Geyser page, geyser.fund/project/infinity. And all the details are there. Also, thank you to Plan B Network for supporting this endeavor. It's how we can make it available for free to everyone, both on Noster and in the video audio segment we have here. So check out Plan B Network for more fantastic educational resources. And we're really happy to be a part of this initiative. A condensed version or abridged version of these recordings is also going to be available on the Plan B Network YouTube channel.
Rumble channel.
And Rumble. It's both.
It's both. Yeah.
Yeah.
All right then.
Okay. So that's Plan B Network. Thanks again to them. And the other one, of course, is Bitbox. They've been a longtime supporter of both of our shows also now. So big shout out to them. Go to bitbox.swiss/infinity. for a discount on the Bitbox 02 hardware wallet, our favorite hardware wallet, fantastic for newbies, super easy to use. So yeah, it's thanks Bitbox. Anything else on those topics there, Knut?
Yes, a final thing for this specific chapter that we just went through, the Sovereignty Through Mathematics. There's a little animation made by Yoni Appleberg, narrated by Guy Swan. So if you search for Bitcoin everything a trade on YouTube, you'll find that video. I highly recommend that, and all of Yoni's other videos for that matter. So check out that. And as Luke said, leave a comment, like, subscribe, and brush your teeth. See you next time.
Yeah, but we're not totally done yet, are we, Knut? Well, we could be, I guess, but just a reminder, everywhere you can see us this upcoming year, we're going to be at a whole bunch of conferences. I think you've got a slightly more full schedule, Knut, so you want to tell us about that?
Oh, yes. thanks for the reminder. So now in May, I'm going to Ireland to a Bitcoin conference there, Bitcoin Ireland, and then we're both going to Prague for BTC Prague. This goes for every single conference and everything else you can buy Bitcoin related on the internet, really. Use code INFINITY for a discount, especially for Prague now. Then we're going to Bitcoin Rodeo in Calgary, Canada. And after that, I'm going to Budapest and you're going to Riga. After that, we're organizing a conference in Helsinki, Finland at the end of August. Middle of August. So, Baltic Honey Badger and Istanbul. Not Istanbul, Budapest. I travel too much. Are on the 8th and 9th of August, and the BTC Hell in Helsinki is on the 15th and 16th, I believe. I think I got that right.
You did get it right. Yeah, exactly. Really great conference schedule coming up. Come say hello. Get a book signed if you want. We'll be there. Looking forward to it. And
Bulgaria and Lugano. Don't forget Lugano. Like the Plan B conference in Lugano is coming up in October. Yes. If we're going through the entire schedule here.
Yeah. I think we're confirming the Bulgaria and Lugano here, but I'm sure we'll wrap those up. Looking forward to all of it. So. But come to Helsinki though, if you can. Seriously, we're really excited about this one. We're gonna have lots of fantastic side events. There's a ton of great speakers lined up already. So this is another one of these ways that you can get the most out of your relationship with us and all this. Come to Helsinki. We'd really love to see you there. It's my adopted hometown, and I'm really excited to show it off to international Bitcoiners, and we're really trying to raise awareness and adoption in Finland and the Nordics more generally. So that's another way you can have a big impact, is to come to Helsinki and show everyone here what Bitcoin is all about. So that's the short pitch. You'll be hearing it constantly until the conference. But we're really excited about it, right, Knut?
Yeah, absolutely. The really short pitch would be go to hell, people.
Perfect. I don't have anything more to add. So is this it? Are we going to put a ribbon on this one now?
I think we're going to put a ribbon on this one right now. All right. Thank you, Luke. See you next time.
Thanks, Knut. And thank you for listening. See you next time.